You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I'm Dan Sershin. I direct the Central Eurasia Project here at the Open Society Foundations. I just wanted to welcome Philip Shishkin, who has recently written a book on our beloved region, the Restless Valley. Alex Cooley has kindly agreed to moderate the discussion with Philip, so without further ado, we'll head right in. So, Alex?
Great. Thank you, Dan. And it's a pleasure to be here with you today with Philip Shishkin, who has written this very intriguing and compelling read, Restless Valley. So the format we agreed upon today was I would have a conversation with Philip, try and hit some of the highlights, or what I consider to be the highlights of the book, and we'll go back and forth, and then after a few rounds, we'll throw it open to your comments, questions, and so forth that you might have for the author. So, Philip, a lot of us in this room know something about Central Asia, or think that we know something about Central Asia, but there's also a lot of generalists in the audience. So perhaps you could just set the stage for us in terms of what this valley is, geographically, politically, culturally. Set the scene for us. So what is the Restless Valley?
Well, thank you all for coming, and thank you, Alex, for moderating. The valley is obviously restless, to state the obvious, but to move beyond jokes. It's so the title of the book refers to Fergana Valley, which is, as many of you know, a very sort of tortured piece of land north of Afghanistan, where several countries come together in this jagged confluence of borders, and where a lot of conflict has taken place over the past few centuries, related to ethnic clashes and all sorts of other conflicts. So I use the title of Restless Valley to talk about the valley itself and its history, but more broadly to talk about the countries that have gone through this really incredible sequence of events over the past decade. As you know, they became independent after the fall of the Soviet Union, and the book focuses mostly on Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan. And on this, not to mince words, this essentially very wild stretch of political upheaval that both countries have gone through. Most of the book takes place in Kyrgyzstan, which quite unusually has gone through not one but two revolutions in the space of 5 years. And the book also talks about Uzbekistan, which, unlike Kyrgyzstan, has retreated deeper and deeper into dictatorship while maintaining a very vibrant security alliance with the United States because of the war in Afghanistan. And just one final thing about the book and about my approach: there is a great amount of very serious scholarship and political science and general knowledge related to the region, including from Alex and from many of you in the audience. So, and I stand on the shoulders of people who have done serious research in the region, but most of my book is based on firsthand reporting in those countries. And my approach was to take this context that I've just given you, this incredibly restless, again, pardon the adjective, I haven't been able to find a better synonym, this very restless stretch of history, and to look at it through the eyes of the people as they live through these events, including both presidents, opposition leaders, mafia kingpins, and regular people caught up in this flow of events. So that's basically the idea.
Great. One of the striking things about the book in terms of recent history, recent political history, is I think the picture you paint about really the darkness that befell Kyrgyzstan in the later Bakiyev years. And to me, this is really one of the most compelling parts of your narrative, that you really map out how bad things had gotten and a kind of a sinister political atmosphere that was there. Could you talk a little bit about those years, some of the episodes that you witnessed? What happened? Was Bakiyev always like this? Is this something he came across? Is this something he was advised to do? How do you see that trajectory?
Thanks. I mean, just by way of background, so Kyrgyzstan had a revolution. It's called the Tulip Revolution, very romantically named, in 2005. It's sort of similar to the Arab Spring revolutions that happened later. And so there was this incredible outpouring of optimism and of this feeling. So, well, we got rid of a corrupt inept regime, and now we're going to build, well, maybe if not a democracy, then a more equitable society where the government does not do nasty things to its citizens. Quite the opposite happened. The the government that came to power on the back of this upsurge of optimism that followed the Tulip Revolution quickly descended into pretty evil, pretty cartoonish, just dictatorship, and started doing things that would be that would look far-fetched if they were written about in a novel, including political very grisly political assassinations, including money laundering on a scale that surprised me, even though I wrote for the Wall Street Journal for a number of years, have a very high tolerance for the for financial crime, not tolerance, but very high threshold of being impressed by financial crime. And it's more broadly, I think, what interested me, and I think probably interests many of you, is the nature of revolutions and regime changes. I think we all think, and I think it's a human nature to think that once you overthrow a bad regime, something better will inevitably follow. I think it's something similar happened in the Arab Spring and in Egypt. You don't have to look very far for the examples. But I think in life, and in politics, and also in life, the opposite quite have. The opposite thing often happens as you go from bad to worse, essentially. And this is what happened in Kyrgyzstan after 2005. And in the book, I decide to write about that period of history by focusing on a few key individuals who were caught up in this, including.
Tell us about them. These are really compelling figures.
Well, one of them is one of the main characters in the book is this person named Medet Sadırkulov. He incredibly was the chief of staff to the first Kyrgyz president, and then after the revolution managed to get reincarnated as the chief of staff to the guy who overthrew the first president. Again, at that time, he sort of personified the, he was very optimistic about this new era of Kyrgyz history, and he essentially became, a conduit for the new regime to assert its power in Kyrgyzstan. And as years went by, he became disillusioned. He saw, not only did he see, but he participated in the very sort of mercurial evil acts of the new government, and eventually he resigned and started enjoying the opposition and became this very formidable figure because he was an insider, he had a lot of connections, a lot of people knew him, he was this just incredible organizer and had a very sharp mind, and so he was murdered in a very elaborately planned contract hit that was disguised as a car crash. And that was hushed up for years and years and years, even though people, of course, who followed this closely suspected that he had been killed and knew that he had been killed, but there is never any official acknowledgement of this. It would take another revolution for the truth of the exact details of how the murder was planned and carried out to come out. And so I spent quite a lot of time talking about it because, to me, in journalism, we often find people. We feel very lucky when we find a person on whom you can hang history, essentially. It's much easier to talk about big events when you find people who represent them well. And this guy just happens to carry a lot of my narrative for me in that part of the book. There's also another person who was involved in a lot of the money laundering schemes of the old regime.
Yeah, we'll get to he'll have his own separate chapter, given his antics, in a little while. Also, can you talk a little bit about Gennady Pavluk and what you found out about him, who he was, what fate awaited him, and how that came to symbolize, again, the Bakiyev years?
Yeah. Well, Gennady Pavluk was an opposition journalist. Again, he's one of the characters in the book. He was a freelancer, and during the Bakiyev era, he allied himself with one of the major sort of opposition figures, and he started writing very critical articles about the regime, about the government. He was one of the very few journalists who kept writing such things. He was killed again in a very elaborate contract assassination. So he was, and this rang very true to me and to anyone who ever freelanced, you're always, and to maybe to anyone who's ever worked in the nonprofit world, there's always the competition for money and grants. It's true of journalism, it's true of academia, it's true of think tanks. So Gennady wanted to start a news portal, and he had no money. So he went around, as many of us have done, trying to convince people to fund his project. And all of a sudden, he almost gives up. And all of a sudden, months later, he gets this email in his inbox from this think tank with a very, very long name, the Union for the Betterment of Relations Between the Common. It had a lot of names, sounded very official, and he was told, look, you're one of the finalists for this $100,000 grant we're about to give for the development of independent media in Central Asia. You're one of the finalists. Would you come to Almaty? It's the it's the commercial hub of Kazakhstan, for a final interview. Well, the guy is a journalist, so he gets suspicious, so he puts the name of the organization to Google. Nothing comes up. He wants the money, but he thinks it's a prank. So he emails the woman, and it's the woman who is emailing him. He tells her that he's a little concerned, that this seems like a joke, and she tells him, well, you know, she ignores his question. She tells him the pool of applicants has shrunk now from 100 to 3, and you're still in the running. You're one of the three, so why don't you come to Almaty, and all your questions will be answered. We've already reserved a room for you in this swanky hotel downtown. And so he needs the money. He thinks, how bad can it get? And so he calls the hotel. There is indeed a room in his name. So he goes over there, and the next day he gets thrown out of a fifth floor window and he dies. Again, the truth of who killed him will have to wait for another revolution. And it's so it later came out that it was planned by a I call him in the book a sort of a Kyrgyz Jason Bourne. He was one of these kind of rogue operative on the payroll of one of the intelligence agencies who's done a lot of shady things on behalf of the regime. And so he was impersonating this grand given woman, and brought him over, and then killed him. So,
it's fascinating stuff. One of the things that strikes me about the book is that I think a lot of the stories that you draw out, the pictures you paint, aren't so much about the valley itself, but rather about some of the figures outside coming into the valley, creating these networks, advising people, setting up these money laundering schemes. And I think candidate number one is Eugene Gurevich. So perhaps you can introduce us to this gentleman and tell us a little bit about what exactly he did for the Bakiyev regime, and why was he so important?
Yeah, he's a fascinating character. I think now he's somewhere in Italy, but he's a Russian. He's of Russian Jewish background. Immigrated to San Francisco when he was a little kid with his mother. Went to business school at Berkeley, I believe, and then because he's so ambitious and crafty, launched himself onto this career of doing incredibly arcane financial stuff in different parts of the world. He started out in Africa, setting up a shop involved in helping Ethiopian companies launder money, essentially. Then he moved on to Italy, where he was one of the associates of the Ndrangheta. Ndrangheta is the Calabrian mafia that engaged in this pretty blatant fraud. It's called carousel fraud. They basically managed to bilk the Italian treasury out of, I think, $500,000 is a conservative figure. I think it was closer to $1 billion by claiming a fraudulent value-added tax refund from the treasury. And he was the guy, he was not the mastermind, but he was engaged by the masterminds to basically be able to do this financially and to then, very importantly, hide the profits. He got indicted in Italy, but before that happened, he moved to Kyrgyzstan because he had been connected to a banker who set up this very small bank in Kyrgyzstan that, after the first revolution under the Bakiyevs, blossomed into this money laundering juggernaut, essentially.
This is Asia Universal.
Asia Universal Bank. Interesting because it had at its heyday in its heyday, it had Bob Dole on its board. They've invested a lot of money into PR, essentially. So they presented this very polished picture to the world. They had all these big names on the board, while at the same time they were engaged in a very elaborate money laundering scheme. They basically set up a bank in the country where money would come in from all sorts of shady outfits overseas and then get laundered, transferred out, and they earned massive commissions on that. Again, we're talking about millions and hundreds of millions of dollars. And that bank was operating under the protection of the president's son. And so Eugene Gurevich, one of the characters after his Italian entanglement before he was indicted, he moved to Kyrgyzstan and sort of used his expertise in financial flows to essentially become a the guy in Kyrgyzstan who helped set up this money laundering operation. He, of course, denies that he laundered money. Anyways, after the revolution, he was smuggled out of the country by these Chechen operatives who actually come from the same village, the same, oddly enough, from the same enclave that the Tsarnaev brothers, the marathon bombers, come from. It's this enclave, it's not an enclave, it's just a part of Kyrgyzstan near the Kazakh border, where a lot of the Chechen diaspora lives. So because Gurevich, after the revolution, became this public enemy number one, he was this Russian Jewish financier, almost like a caricature. The Italian indictment became public, and so the new government, their big thing after the revolution was, the Bakiev government ripped us off, stole millions and millions of dollars, and all of a sudden they had this bogeyman. So look at this,
So he's lying low in Bishkek. After the revolution, the Bakiyevs have already gotten out, and presumably he's one of public enemies number one. And yeah, tell us a little bit about the plot he hatches with the Chechen group to get out.
So he's people are looking for him because they think he has a lot of money and has a lot of answers for where the money might be. The owner of the bank and the president's son, they're all out of the country. He's the only one, and so he manages to get his wife and daughter out of the country because people are not looking for them. But he at that point has a Interpol warrant, Interpol red alert, because the Italian indictment had just come out. So the Italians are looking for him. And the Kyrgyz government is looking for him, so he can't go anywhere. So he's sitting in this apartment in Bishkek by himself with a fever. Doesn't know what to do. And eventually these Chechen guys find him. Well, he thinks that, his former colleagues just basically ratted him out. The Chechen guys just tell him, we'll get you out. It's going to cost you. He has no choice. They put him in the car, and they drive off through Tokmok, which is this Chechen settlement close to Kazakhstan. So they drive into Kazakhstan, and then they present him with the bill, $20 million. He says he has no money. They eventually, take about $400,000 or $500,000, all his savings. He says they take his passport. So he's in Almaty with no money, with no passport. He's under Italian indictment. The Kyrgyz are looking for him. So he goes to the U.S. consulate, and he thinks, so he plot, he hatches. He decides that it's much better to be arrested by the Italians than by the Kyrgyz, and so you can go to Italy, they're probably not going to lynch you.
Or it's like forum shopping for, crooked financiers.
So he goes to the U.S. consulate, and he says, and that he has a lawyer in New York who's talking to the State Department here, and so he goes, he's going to want to surrender. I want to surrender to you so that you then deliver me to the Italians. And, I don't want to go to Kyrgyzstan because they'll kill me, which is probably true. And the U.S. embassy, that is his story, the U.S. embassy wouldn't comment on any of this other than to confirm that he did go to the embassy. The U.S. embassy says, no, you're on your own. So they issue him a new passport. And then at that time, most of the Bakiyev family had resettled in Belarus and Minsk. Another fascinating country, subject for another book that I hope someone will write. And at that point, as Gurevich is getting desperate, he gets a call from Maxim Bakiyev, who's the son of the ousted president, very wealthy guy, the guy on whose behalf Gurevich had been essentially doing all sorts of financial slates of hand. Maxim gets him out. He puts him on a plane that flies him to Minsk, to Belarus. And Gurevich, and I talked to a lot of people about him, and finally, after I sent him a lot of emails, he finally agreed to meet with me, and we actually met not far from here, in Central Park South, where he used to rent an apartment, and we talked for a while. And so he tells me, Maxim got me out because I had, I was essentially his banker. I had helped him with a lot of things, and so he thought that Maxim had a business idea in mind, and that's why he helped him. And so at that time, I sort of wrote it down and forgot about that until, actually about probably about a year later, it turns out that there had been an American case against against Gurevich for extortion related to Kyrgyzstan. So to cut a long story short, Gurevich turned an FBI informant. And at the time, Gurevich and Maxim were engaged in the insider trading in the U.S. So there was an SEC case. So Gurevich, to escape, to seek leniency because of the U.S. investigation into him, basically agreed to wear a wire. I don't think he wore a wire, but he recorded a lot of stuff on Skype. Gave the FBI this money laundering conspiracy, essentially, insider trading conspiracy involving the son of the former president and this other guy in London, with pretty with details about companies, classic insider trading ahead of IPOs or mergers, that including big companies. So Maxim then was, there was a U.S. warrant for his arrest. Maxim lived in London based on the evidence that Gurevich presented. The U.S. decided not to pursue charges against Maxim. I do not know why. This just happened basically 2 weeks ago. I don't know why the U.S. dropped the charges. So Maxim is in London now. Gurevich, I think, is in Italy. He has kind of fallen off the grid a little bit. But last I heard from him, he was on his way to Italy, and I think he was talking to the Italian investigators about like a settlement, or Italian authorities about a settlement. I had emailed him just shortly before the book came out. I had emailed him to see if we could talk again after all the stuff about his work for the FBI surfaced, and he wrote back to say the timing is terrible. I haven't heard from him again, so that's the story.
Yeah, it reminds me of another high-profile case of the James Giffen case in Kazakhstan, sort of the intrigue, the trial, and then, all these things come up in the last week before the trial.
There are all sorts of conspiracy theories. Yeah, Some of them have a foothold in reality, actually.
Tell us a little bit about, you paint this wonderful portrait, wonderful but very vivid portrait of Lake Kyrgyzstan. What's the U.S. reaction to all of these developments? What is the U.S. Principally concerned with or engaged with in Kyrgyzstan at this time?
So another sort of layer of intrigue in the book is the fact that the U.S. has been heavily engaged in the region through all of it because of the war in Afghanistan. The U.S. has used Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan as a place to put up big military bases and for transshipment rights. So the U.S. was... it still is very much engaged in the region. In Kyrgyzstan, interestingly enough, in the run-up to the first revolution, the U.S. at the time was very much involved in a democracy promotion. The U.S. played a role in the Tulip Revolution, in terms of supporting the civil society. The Tulip Revolution was carried out by the local opposition. But the U.S. support, financial and moral, did help. I mean, it was the time when democracy promotion was very high on the U.S. agenda. When an interesting thing happened after the revolution, when the Bakiyev government came to power and became obviously very corrupt and bad, not to mince words, and all of a sudden the U.S. Tamped down its democracy promotion rhetoric, and the thinking was that the U.S. maintains this very large military base there. Alex has written about this intrigue much better than I. But faced with the evidence of the abuses of the new government, the U.S. basically kept silent because they wanted to maintain the base and they did not want to rock the boat. And it's the Russians who supported the opposition the second time around.
Yeah.
The Russians were angry and disappointed because they've been plotting Bakiyev to kick out the American military base. The Russians also have a base there. Actually, here I should say that Alex has written a great book, Great Games, Local Rules, that talks a lot about the base politics in Kyrgyzstan and in Central Asia. But basically, Bakiyev promised the Russians that he was going to kick the Americans out. The same day, all happens during the press conference in Moscow. The Russians promise him this multi-billion dollar package of loans and grants, and the Americans are concerned, and we know part of this through WikiLeaks, so the ambassador in Bishkek starts writing cables to Washington saying, we need to pay more, we need to raise the rent for the base, because otherwise he's going to take the Russian money and kick us out. I mean, she basically wrote that. I'm paraphrasing, but it's very close. The essence of the cable was that, and the U.S. raises the rent. Bakiev takes the money, tells the Russians. I don't know what he tells the Russians, but the upshot is, it seems like he tells the Russians, I'm not going to kick out the Americans. And then what happens is a series of scathing news reports and documentaries airs on Russian television about the Bakiev government. The Russian state television is, of course, a staple in Kyrgyz homes and across the former Soviet Union. So this anti-Bakiev PR campaign takes place a few months before the revolutions. So you have the first revolution that was supported by the Americans while the Russians were sort of silent. The second revolution supported by the Russians while the Americans were silent. I'm simplifying and exaggerating, but the essence is not far from the truth.
And I think what complicates it even further, that there are actors on the ground who actively want to take credit for that, right? Both in terms of the USAID contractors on one hand, and then Russian intelligence operatives sort of saying, that was all our doing. So it's very difficult to sort out who's doing what and who's really to blame and so forth, this part of the world. Thanks for the reference to my basing thing. The only thing I would add is it was a really interesting time in terms of how a lot of, not just U.S., Western operatives interpreted a lot of the violence that you're describing. That for some reason, a lot of people say, well, this is almost a sign of political stability. Like, reporters going off of windows and so forth. Just that Bakiev regime, it's so stable. It was just a bizarre kind of reasoning that the authoritarianism in and of itself was proof that the regime was going to last, which I thought was a fundamental misreading of recent Kyrgyz history, as you sort of put out. Let's switch countries for a sec, because one of the most poignant chapters of the book is what you find after the events of Andijan in that city. So a lot of us here are familiar with the events of Andijan, but maybe you can just provide a capsule summary and then tell us how you got in and what you found those days that you were doing your reporting there.
Yeah, and so as many of you know, Islam Karimov, for the president of Uzbekistan, in power uninterrupted since the early 90s, a textbook case of very brutal dictatorship, and has been from day one, and also our ally because of the transshipment rights for Afghanistan. So he has been, one of his big campaigns has been against militant Islam ever since he came to power. Ironically, his first name is Islam, but it's, as I read in the book, never has a man wore his first name with more irony. I mean, he's engaged in a very brutal, elaborate campaign against Muslims of all stripes. And there have been Islamists in Uzbekistan. They're not all, peaceful believers, as they will have them believe. There have been violent, Islamists seeking to overthrow the government of Uzbekistan. But Karimov has largely used that threat, or that perceived threat, to crack down across the board. I mean, we've seen something similar in Egypt, too, so he's in no way unique. He's used the kernel of truth to then launch the massive, to run with the metaphor, jihad, essentially, against Islamists, but also against any sort of whiff of organized opposition. And so coming back to Andijan, this is 2005, he, as part of his campaign against Islamists, he jails, or his courts, his prosecutors, put a dozen businessmen in the town of Andijan on trial. Now, they ran a very successful small and medium-sized businesses, employed a lot of people. They were accused of belonging to this very obscure, heretofore unknown Islamist sect called Path to Faith. So they were facing trial in Uzbekistan and a lot of the countries in that part of the world. If there's a case against you, there's pretty close to 100% conviction rate. And in Uzbek jails, there's a lot of torture. So that's the context. So these guys are on trial in Andijan. They go to jail. A jailbreak happens. So their friends, their allies, their families, they put together a jailbreak. Some of them are armed, so they're by no means completely innocent Boy Scouts. They storm the prison. Some people have compared to the, sort of the Bastille Day in France, where they storm the prison as the bastion of oppression. Others have said less generously that they are armed thugs, maybe with terrorist connections, that stormed this jail. I think the truth lies somewhere in between. I think it was mostly a desperate act by a few thugs, because they knew if they don't do this, this guy is going to disappear into prison forever. So the jail was stormed alongside the 12 or 15 people from that jail. Everyone else escapes from prison. And then something else happens. There's a massive rally in Andijan that day, attended by people who had nothing at all to do with those businessmen or the jailbreak. It was commotion in town. A lot of people were dissatisfied with the government as it is. So people...
So it's a rally in the central square.
It's a fairly small town. It's a rally in the central square. People start pouring in, or they're coming home from work, or and then they see something's happening. They go. So hundreds and hundreds of people congregate on that square. 90% of them had nothing to do with the jailbreak or the people in prison. They're either gawkers or just passers-by or people who happen to be in the area. So they go in there, and there's a loudspeaker that's passed around the crowd. There's some talk that the local officials, maybe even Kerimov himself, might come to town to address the rally. The rally mostly talks about just the daily problems of, you know, of Andijan. Something else happens. Kerimov dispatches the military, and a massacre takes place. It has been said that it's, you know, the bloodiest crackdown on peaceful protesters since Andijan, or since Tiananmen in China in 89. There's no figure of how many people died that day. I mean, estimates range from a few hundred to over 1,000, most of them innocent civilians, kids, a lot of kids. I at the time when this happened, I was actually in Brussels when the massacre was happening, but I kept traveling back and forth to the region. I had been in Uzbekistan just a month before. I wanted to get in, and so I flew to Tashkent. I have a Russian passport, so I can travel easily in those places. And I get a car in the airport, and I decide to drive to Andijan. Of course, there's a police siege. They're not letting anyone in because they're cleaning up essentially a massacre scene and getting ready to present an alternative story for public consumption, that it was a terrorist uprising that was dealt with swiftly and justly. Wasn't true, so they don't let me in. And the next day, I go to the local airline, and turns out there are direct flights. So as I say in the book, like in a dictatorship, incompetence is a virtue. So they cut off traffic to Andijan, but they forgot to cancel flights over their own siege. So I flew in to a neighboring town, and then drove in, and then I was just with a very a brave local colleague, Abdul Malik Baboyev, who I believe now is in exile. Germany helped me a lot, so we flew in together, and we were able for 2 days to report there, talking to survivors. And this was before, so I was there probably 2 days after the massacre, maybe a little sooner. About a few days later, the Uzbek government started silencing anyone who spoke out. There was a human rights defender that we spoke to, who was then jailed for 7 years. Few days later, and a lot of the victims or the families of the victims were not yet fully intimidated. They were mostly dazed and in mourning, and so they talked very freely about what had happened. And so we spent a few days reporting there.
And tell us a little bit about just the atmospherics and the scenes of what you found. I mean, just some of the physical evidence of what had transpired. Like, what did it look like?
When I got there, most of the bodies had been already cleaned up. You could still see some, but not many. But there's a story. There's one story I talk about in the book. It was about this guy who just turned 16, and it was the massacre took place, and it was actually Friday the 13th, May 13th, 2005, and his mother. His name is Yogdor Beck. His mother wanted to cook a meal the next day and have a big birthday party. So and she realized she didn't have enough meat, and so she asked him to go and buy more meat. And so he picked up a friend. They're both 16 years old, and they walked off to the market. Well, as they were walking to the market, this uprising happened, and so the rally. So they got onto the square, and he never came home. He never came home, and his mother and older brother spent the next day. Looking for him, and so they're basically walking through Andijan, and at that point, it's a massacre. So there are bodies everywhere. They're like stopping by the side of the road, lifting, sheets, looking at faces, going to hospitals and morgues, and finally they find him in a morgue. He's dead. The friend is dead too. And so there are a lot of stories like that there. So the Uzbek government later, kept saying that those are just terrorists and it's their fault, and there are very few innocent victims. But this is patently untrue. The follow-up to that is the U.S. had a military base there, and so after the massacre, there was a debate actually within the administration about how to respond. So. To make it black or white, do we keep silent and probably keep the base, or do we speak out and probably face the consequences? And some of this is detailed in Donald Rumsfeld's memoir, yeah. Actually, which is fascinating. So he, of course, says that we should have kept silent, because if we take the approach that we criticize every dictator for what he does at home, then we won't be able to do business with countries whose help we need. And that's hard and cold, but that's also true. I mean, we do need countries that are not democracies. We deal with them all the time. Anyways, but at the time, the doves prevailed, and the U.S. did criticize Karimov, and he kicked out the base. A few years later, the U.S. is back there. There is no base, but there are all sorts of transshipment agreements for Afghanistan. Of course, now the U.S. is ready to withdraw the troops. Uzbekistan will play a big role again. And so 5 years after Andijan, the U.S. essentially quietly, resuscitated its alliance with this guy. For the pure expediency of Afghanistan. That's sort of the story.
Right. Here. Of course, NATO has just opened an office in Tashkent formally, and the U.S., Germany, and the U.K., they'll all be reverse transiting out of Uzbekistan. The U.S. can also use Pakistan routes, but the Brits and the Germans don't have a choice, mm-hmm. given where they are. They have to go through there and do those deals. One final segment before we throw it out, regarding what happened again in the valley in June of 2010, and you document these violent episodes between ethnic Uzbeks and Kyrgyz, and here you probably know what's coming on my end, because I flagged this a little bit, but you refer to the events that happened as a civil war, and I just wanted to give you a chance to tell us, what do you mean by using this term? Why is this a civil war for you? How do you see the dynamics of the conflict, the aftermath of the conflict? What did you find when you were there?
No, it's a good question. So just briefly to back up. So after the second revolution in Kyrgyzstan, this ethnic clashes broke out in the south of Kyrgyzstan between the Kyrgyz and the Uzbeks, who, constitute a very big ethnic minority in the south of Kyrgyzstan, which borders on Uzbekistan. So about 400 people died. Most of them were Uzbeks. And so the clashes, so the Kyrgyz state could fall back on friendly police and prosecutors and later judges when investigations took place. The Uzbeks basically had only themselves. And so there was fighting between armed gangs, skirmishes here and there. Most of the victims were Uzbeks. I call it the civil war, and I know others have criticized me for using that term, because it implies almost a clash between equally well-armed combatants. But I covered the civil war in Iraq, and there was also a debate whether you can call it the civil war, because it didn't look like our civil war or any other civil wars. But I think I use it sort of more loosely, and maybe it's not 100% correct, but it basically implies just that civil clashes between various armed groups. Some may have state support, some may not. In the book, I spent in my approach. Is oftentimes to focus on individual cases, and sometimes maybe that sort of kind of misses the broader context, but I think it makes for a better, like a more visceral understanding of what happened. I focus on one case where a curious policeman was brutally murdered in the middle of a rally, and the person who was jailed for organizing his murder is this Uzbek human rights activist. Many of you know the name. People have kind of adopted his cause now. He's still in prison, serving out a life sentence, Azimjan Askarov.
Who you also interviewed.
I've interviewed him before the government kind of stopped allowing people to. I interviewed him in prison. So that kind of followed the pattern of the after the Civil War, or the civil, whatever term of art one may want to use, after the violence. So there are all these investigations, and even though most of the victims were of the clashes were Uzbek, well, in those investigations, prosecutions, the Uzbeks turned out to be also the perpetrators, disproportionately so. And Askarov was one of them. He From the available evidence, it seems that he was framed by the Kyrgyz police, who did not like him for reasons of him having been a human rights defender, who accused the police of all sorts of crimes before the clashes by friendly Kyrgyz judges. So he was he was tortured and beaten up, and so I kind of use his case and also the case of the policeman to talk about the kind of the broader dynamics of the civil war. Anyways, he's still in jail.
And then I guess just one more. Now that you've written the book and it's out there, and it is remarkable that everything in here is this compressed sort of 5-year period. Has your thinking about the region changed at all? I mean, how do you view this 5 years? This is an exceptional 5 years. Looking forward, I would never ask you to go on the record and predict what's going to happen. But is this sort of these bouts of instability, are these likely to recur, or is this sort of a unique time where you had sort of, you know, colored revolutions and this geopolitical intrigue and so forth? With your perspective now sitting in Beijing, what do you make of this period that you spend in Central Asia and that you've documented so compellingly in this book?
Thank you. It's hard to predict. The sort of one thing that has given me, I mean, when I started reporting in the region in 2003 and the first revolution in Kyrgyzstan, I along with probably a few other people, kind of fell for this fallacy of democracy that will follow a revolution. People kind of use those words liberally after the first revolution, democracy, so, you know, freedom, and all that. So I've become very skeptical, and I've stopped using those terms when it comes to Kyrgyzstan. I mean, there's still constant, one of the chapters is called The Land of Perpetual Revolution, so there's constant a tumult in that country. Will there be another revolution? I hope not. The government now is ineffectual and weak, but it's by no means as corrupt or as consciously evil, pardon the loaded term, as its predecessor. Now, the interesting part is what happens in Uzbekistan. I mean, Kyrgyzstan, for all the intrigue it managed to pack into its very small territory, is still that. It's very small. Uzbekistan is a big place, like almost 30 million people. When Karimov goes, and even though it seems like he'll never go, natural causes will take effect. Eventually, they have to, right? And so he will go, and it's unclear what will happen there. And there are all sorts of stress factors. I mean, there are Islamists, there are all sorts of opposition groups, many of them abroad and not very effectual. So what happens when that shoe drops is unclear. It's hard to predict, but I think we'll see a lot more unrest there, and so maybe there'll be a restless valley too.
Valley stays restless. Okay, great. Well, so let's take some comments and some questions from the audience. Just let us know who you are, and then we'll start here.
Yes, on Life, you reach Democracy Initiative, and this is a question specific to the Maxim Bakiev situation and the attempts, or the feeble, as I think, attempts of the Otumbayeva government to go after and try to find the money that the family, the clan, was said to have stashed away. My feeling is that they haven't really pursued it in good faith, though they do say to the public that they're still after it. It doesn't seem like they're really earnestly trying to.
You mean the new Kyrgyz government?
The new Kyrgyz money, and trying to find the money and what happened to it. What is your sense about what is going on there?
No, it's a good question, and it's true. They have launched a number of investigations. I think quite a few of them are open, and they have not yet come up with a massive haul of money. And maybe if they have, maybe they have pocketed it. I don't know. I mean, we saw that after the first revolution too. These investigations were open amid sort of great fanfare, and then people realize that there's actually money to be made using the same corrupt schemes. I'm not saying the current government is doing that, but. You know, we have to remember that some of the same characters are involved from revolution to revolution. And so, after the first one, a good example would be something I talk about in the book, the corruption involving the fuel contracts for the American military base, multi-million-dollar contracts, very lucrative. So, during the Akayev governments before the first revolution, his son-in-law controlled those deliveries, and so the Americans were kind of in business with him. And then after the revolution, the Kyrgyz government started investigating corruption, made all these noises, and all of a sudden, this is fascinating to talk about it to the former Kyrgyz ambassador who was involved in this in Washington. And all of a sudden, so she was pressing all this because the FBI was involved, and all of a sudden she gets a signal from the government, just cool it. Because they've seen how it's done, and they're like, great, we'll do the same thing, because there's so much money at stake. I won't lie to you, I don't know what the state of those investigations in terms of finding money is, but given the prior history of such investigations, I wouldn't be too optimistic. And also, there are some people who knew how to hide money. So,
shocked.
Yes, sir. Peter Pauly, long-term volunteer in the area. My question is, if it can be answered, will be probably by both of you. A wonderful apotheosis of money laundering, the Asia Universal Bank in Bishkek had three directors, three U.S. senators. Bob Dole is one of them. Does anybody have any idea whether those senators were actually paid as directors?
Yes, they were paid. So there was Bob Dole, and there was Johnston, I think his last name is. They were paid, and this is someone told me this who was familiar with their hiring. They were paid $175,000 a year for. I tried to reach Bob Dole; he wouldn't speak to me. But Senator Johnston did speak to me. He didn't confirm or deny the compensation level. They were paid a lot of money for very little work, but they were paid for just one reason: to provide legitimacy to this operation. They had a few board meetings. They were also promised stock options because Asia Universal Bank was on the cusp of an IPO when the revolution happened. They had established links with major financial institutions in the area, all the big ones, Citibank and others. I'm actually not sure about Citibank, so I probably shouldn't throw out names if I'm not sure, but big financial, international financial institutions were involved, and so they were also promised stock options, which they never got because there was never an IPO. But they were paid. Gurevich, interestingly enough, contributed $4,000 or $5,000 to the re-election campaign of Bob Dole's wife, who was, I think, running for Senate or Congress. I don't remember. Seeking re-election, and she eventually lost. But it was just a funny nugget before, so he gave her $5,000, and she at the time ran this ad on television against her opponent, accusing her opponent of taking money from godless Americans. She took money from some NGO that, was not religious enough in her. Anyway, so yes, they were paid, as far as I know.
Yes, sir.
These Central Asian countries.
Who are you?
Oh, John Berushi, unaffiliated. These Central Asian countries belong to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. To what extent has China penetrated this region, and for what purpose are they doing
this? Good question. You're in Beijing. What's the view in Beijing about Beijing?
Would you like to take that?
You first. Okay. You first.
Well, Beijing. A few things there. The Chinese are very worried about American military presence in the region. I mean, so we say that our bases in Afghanistan, but also in Kyrgyzstan and elsewhere in the region, are for those purposes. The Chinese see it differently. They're worried about being encircled. And this climate of tensions between these two countries, the Chinese have basically tried to get the Americans out of the region, and they've used the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to issue a declaration a few years ago asking the Central Asian governments to set a date for the withdrawal of American forces. Beyond the bases, the Chinese have also used, the Chinese have this three evils doctrine, so the things that they consider very dangerous to the stability of the state, it's extremism, terrorism, and separatism. So they place them equal, they rate them equally grave risks. And so they've used that to crack down on Uyghur separatism, because some of these guys are based in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. So they've essentially exported their domestic way of dealing with dissent and opposition to Central Asia, and the Central Asians have been very receptive to this because their systems are similar, especially in Uzbekistan. They have put a lot of the Uzbeks, for instance, security services put a lot of pressure on the neighboring countries to extradite all sorts of opponents back to Uzbekistan, or failing that, they would just go across the border and kill them, which also happened. But so that's, it's you know, it's an interesting organization.
Yeah, and I think your point you make about exporting this internal doctrine, that very much frames a lot of the types of engagement that China has with the region. Economically, China's providing a lot of development assistance, building a lot of infrastructure, but they're doing it from the perspective of wanting to develop the western province of Xinjiang. So it's this sort of, you know, inside-out type of strategy. And the reasoning is very much, you know, if Xinjiang develops, then it will become more politically stable. And how do we get it developed? We try and connect it and so forth and build greater links to the outside world.
One follow-up is, are they putting pressure on the government of Pakistan, which they're allies, right, to clamp down on the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan? Are they putting pressure on Pakistan to, you know, they're operating in those Fatah areas of Pakistan, so I would think they would put some pressure on Pakistan to try to get them out.
The Islamic movement in Uzbekistan is sort of this, so a lot of them before, you know, a lot of them died, right? They were fighting with the Taliban, right after the 2001 U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. So a lot of them were killed. The question of how effective they are and how much of a threat they pose is an open question. I mean, you have the government of Uzbekistan who exaggerates their threat. There's no doubt there are some diehard IMU operatives in those areas. I do think the sort of the Islamist factor is a little bit overplayed, and I'm sure they're, you know, the Uzbeks are putting a lot of pressure on Afghanistan and on Pakistan to deal with that. Yeah, what's your sense of
this? Yeah, I mean, I think there's very high level dialogues between China and Pakistan, but a lot of it from the Pakistani perspective is to try and posture to domestic audience that they have an alternative to the states, right? So, yes, there are links, there are discussions. There's concern about, I think a few months ago, that some violence in Xinjiang was inspired by a group that was sort of nurtured in Pakistan and so forth. But I think a lot of it is to sort of signal domestically that there are sort of other alternatives to just being sort of the U.S. security partner, and the economic relationship is really taking off, as it is with, you know, China and a number of these countries.
That's another important point, if I just may add very, very, very briefly. I mean, both the U.S. and Russia have engaged in all sorts of intrigue in the region, have meddled incredibly in the internal affairs of this country. So China actually has not that we know of. Their foreign policy is obviously not as transparent as ours, or at least not publicly discussed, but in the region there is not a perception, at least not yet, the Chinese are trying to overthrow governments or get a base in there or make sure that another base gets kicked out, even though there were indications that they're obviously doing that. And so, but they're exporting a lot. I mean, they view Central Asia as a place that has a lot of gas and oil that China needs. So they've been very active in building pipelines, negotiating export agreements. So their role has not been all negative, but by no means, very positive, like development cooperation and all that. But people are afraid of China because people are afraid of China because it's big and big and very big and with a lot of ambitions. So there is that almost, nebulous fear.
Very much so. Yes, sir.
Malcolm Arnold. Elizabeth Dole was president of the Red Cross, American Red Cross, and also a senator. In that area, are you seeing the money laundering being used with NGOs and policies of USAID? How is that coming together in that region? The State Department makes no bones about it. Foundations make no bones about it, that they work together as far as projecting, you know, American interests. But how are you seeing that money laundering and et cetera? How is that working in that space? The foundations with government interests, with corporate interests, et cetera.
You mean the aid being misused or being diverted?
Or a concern with money laundering so that we launch anti-money laundering projects. Do you mean that?
Right. Already? Well, so you can take the money laundering and then donate it back to foundations, right?
Oh, I see.
And the money's being laundered in a way that's going back to the foundations that then are then propagating a certain agenda that helps the regime that's in power or in combination with U.S. interests.
Yeah, Well, Kyrgyzstan is just to back up. I mean, in a region that has basically stamped out NGOs, Kyrgyzstan is stands apart because they've had an incredible amount of NGOs involved in all sorts of activities. A lot of them are funded by from U.S. source and from Europe too. And Akayev joked that if the Netherlands is a land of tulips, then Kyrgyzstan is a land of NGOs. And so he created this sort of climate of this very permissive climate for these non-governmental organizations to come in. They were not all involved in politics. They were involved in rural healthcare and agriculture, but also in politics. And so in that sort of the seeds of that sort of the civil society, kind of planning the Akayev days. The irony is, of course, he was overthrown in large part because he allowed the civil society to take root, and then it essentially outgrew him and created this infrastructure and this culture of protest that helped overthrow him. So I'm not sure how much money laundering there has been with the NGOs. I think from what I've seen, it's mostly been done with businesses because there's just the pot of money so much bigger.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I mean,
I think actually this is a little bit of a growing issue that's of concern to the activist community, that NGOs are being stifled under the pretext of combating money laundering, that these Financial Action Task Force recommendations against anti-terrorism and money laundering are being wielded to change domestic legislation to make it much easier to clamp down on the activities of a lot of NGOs. So I think there's a potential for abuse there in the name of anti-money laundering. But I think, as Phil says, the big players here are the untraceable correspondent accounts, right? Places like Asia Universal had, and the report that you also cite, the Global Witness report on grave secrecy, does a wonderful job of just pointing out all of the hundreds of different correspondent accounts and offshore vehicles that were routed through this.
Yeah, for those interested in the region or in money laundering or just in plain old investigative reporting, that report is really worth reading, Global Witness, Grave Secrecy. They've spent months, if not years, just using forensic accounting and investigative reporting to just trace in elaborate detail paths of single money transfers. It's very, very hard to do because there are people who get paid a lot of money to make sure that this is untraceable.
Right.
And so they haven't gotten all the answers, but they have come closer than anyone else to basically giving you a map of how it worked. I cite it in the book, but yeah.
And one more here. Yes, sir.
I'm John Townsend. I'm a family friend, Philip, of your in-laws.
I know who you are.
That's my only reason. Not my only reason for being here, because I read the book. I found it terrific and fascinating, and a lot of it new to me. I was particularly interested, something I didn't know, that Stalin, sort of in the style of the British in the Middle East, had taken out his red pencil and drawn the borders of the stands, I guess, in the 30s. What do we know about his own Georgian background, ethnicity, influencing that particular decision, and his perception of how the various ethnic groups would get along or not get along within the new Soviet empire?
Yeah, and if I just, it's a really good place, I think, also to end, and just to get your take on how much of the restlessness in the valley stems from that. How much of it is perhaps opportunistically attributed to that, and so forth, between these different actors pursuing their own agendas. Does it all come back to Stalin?
A lot of Russian stories do come back to Stalin sooner or later. But I'm not an expert on Stalin. I'm sure there are people in the room who know more about it than I do. But my sense of it is that, his overriding goal was unity of the country, and he was not going to stop at anything to assure that. And so his ethnic policies were basically designed to weaken any potential challenge to the central state. And he did that in part. Well, one thing he did, he was just the uprooted entire ethnicities that he felt were unreliable and tossed them into Siberia, including the Chechens and the Germans and the Turks, many of whom lived within the Soviet Union. In Central Asia, at the time in the 20s and the beginning of the century, there was a significant sort of pan-Turkism. I mean, these peoples, the Uzbeks and Kyrgyz and Kazakhs and Turkmen, they did not necessarily, they saw themselves as such. They had those identities, but they had sort of a super identity of being this Hispanic, Turkic, you know, identity. Stalin was in other Soviet, you know, ethnicities. Alchemists were very afraid of that because, you know, all of a sudden you would have not like four or five little countries, but you'd have like a lot of people united under this umbrella of, you know, pan-Turkism perhaps, and they have Islam, and so if you join, you know, you can sort of, you know, you sit there with like enough, you know, Georgian wine, you can just sort of see how this could become a problem. And so his idea was to just sort of divide and conquer. You know, there's a historian, I think it is Svet Susek. He has a book on Central Asia. He talks a lot about this, and it's the best description I found. So it's those are not fake boundaries. They're not fake. They're not just randomly drawn, and they're not fake ethnicities. But the lines were drawn in such a way that divided people, divided clans, divided families, divided ethnicities, And coming back to your question, Alex, so in the Soviet Union, it didn't really matter that much because there are sort of lines on the map, but it began to matter with independence when, you know, especially in the valley, in the Fergana Valley, where, as you say, those jagged border lines came into being, and a lot of, you know, so Fergana Valley is a fairly crowded piece of land, and the competition for resources and for land is pretty intense. So when the independence in those countries became independent, there were clashes over land, and then obviously in 2010, ethnic clashes between the Kyrgyz and Uzbeks. Ethnicity does play a role, but I think the underlying reason is sort of the lack of development and the poverty and sometimes very sort of exclusionary policies of the governments. Like in Kyrgyzstan's case, obviously there's no real attempt. Well, there are attempts, but there's no real successful way of integrating these minorities. So it doesn't all go back to Stalin, but there are certainly things that he did that we still see, you know, consequences of today.
Yeah, great. All righty. Well, Philip, thank you so much. Will you be around to sign some of the books? From the book? Yeah.
I should also say, if I may, so big thanks to the Central Eurasia Project, eurasianet.org. They didn't have to host me. And you know, you sit in a silo writing a book for 2 years, and then all of a sudden people come out and support you, including you who come here. So I'm very grateful to all of you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks to everyone.